David, thank you so much for joining us. It's always a great honor and joy to have you share all of your insights and wisdom into homeopathy. We really appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much, Kim. It's a pleasure.
And I did introduce you last week. I'm just going to give you a short introduction for those of you who don't know David personally. David is an individual of the utmost integrity, somebody who I personally respect tremendously, a very principled individual who has basically devoted his life to the practice and teaching of homeopathy. He's one of the top practitioners in North America. He's an excellent educator. He's the founder of the Hudson School of Homeopathy in upstate New York. He's just an all-around great person, somebody who I am proud to call a very close and dear friend, and somebody who I've learned a tremendous amount from. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Kim, it's my pleasure, and welcome all.
Thanks, David. So, David, last week's presentation was absolutely fascinating. The whole lecture on Kent's A Simple Substance, the ideas behind that were just totally mind-blowing for me, and I think the other people who participated felt the same way. Before we actually launch into the second session, I thought perhaps you could kind of give us a 3 or 4 minute summary of what you covered last week, just in case any of the new listeners might not be familiar with some of the concepts, and perhaps even for some of the people who were on the call, a little review would be helpful. So if you could just give us a quick overview of the last interview there, I think that would be very helpful.
I'd be glad to. And again, thanks so much for the opportunity and for Whole Health Now leading the way to the best of homeopathy in the world.
Well, thank you. And it's great to work with people like yourself, David, so thank you.
So last week I introduced the ideas of Kent's notion of a simple substance, and I'll just try as best I can from my notes to give a thumbnail synopsis of that. So in summary, Kent's lecture number 8 in his lectures on homeopathic philosophy, which I highly recommend, is an exploration of what he calls simple substance. And it's an explication on a grand elaboration of Hahnemann's aphorism number 9 of the Organon, where he introduces the meaning of the spiritual vital force and its relationship to the health and purpose of life for all individuals. And just to refresh everyone's memory, since this is the totality of Aphorism 9, I'll just read that. And this is Hahnemann from the Organon, and he says, "In the healthy condition of man, the spiritual vital force, the dynamis that animates the material body, rules with unbounded sway and retains all parts of the organism in admirable, harmonious vital operation as regards both sensations and functions, so that our indwelling, reason-gifted mind can freely employ this living, healthy instrument for the higher purposes of our existence." And for me, that's just healing and... So, in order to delve more deeply into the purpose of spiritual vital force, Kent uses this lecture number 8 and feels obliged to reveal the exact nature of its origin, that is, vital force. In doing so, he postulates a universal cosmology that essentially states that the very birth or beginning of the universe, there was a certain something, whether one wants to call it God or the Big Bang Theory really doesn't make any difference. But that had to exist and to precede that first event. Hence, he says that form precedes energy, which is already a radical shift from the way many people think. And furthermore, he contends that this form had a number of attributes and was disseminated as lawfulness in a uniform disbursement throughout the entire universe from the moment of that initial beginning of all beginnings. And among these attributes, he would say, is this lawfulness was a creation of two types of substances, each having their own distinct properties, and each inexorably interfacing with one another. And then he goes to expound on this, and he says, for the first and the most obvious to us in our experience is what we call concrete or material substance. And these would include all of the entities and forms found in nature and derived from nature. But the second type of substance was immaterial or simple substances, Kent says. But in this latter case, he claims that it's substance nonetheless. And in this case, it contains numerous properties of a different quality than those found in the first material or concrete substance. Then he further suggests that it's the simple substance that is the matrix that holds the entire universe together and maintains all of the assigned properties and attributes given to all for all things, including us human beings. And this is accomplished by a number of various characteristics that belong to simple substance alone. The first of these, we might say, are those properties that, as part of its essence, are the attributes of what Ken calls influx and continuance. And here he metaphorically illustrates this point, that the universe is like a great chain where from the very beginning all things without exception are linked together, and he writes the following: "Do we not thus see that there is a continuous dependence from the last to the first hook?" So as this initiating influx and its counterpart, a perpetuating continuance, maintain and create everything existing in the universe, humanity, as we've come to know it, is but a part of that ever-emerging evolution, and thus a link on that great chain. And another significant aspect of simple substance is that it's ordained with intelligence, again derived from that originating entity, and that each thing unerringly retains its individuality according to its purposefulness and is ordained with the intelligence to fulfill its mandate before it inevitably returns to its ultimates, that is, before it goes into nothing except simple substance. Human beings in this regard are really no different, and under the lawfulness of simple substance, than any other entity in the universe. But we are only distinguished by our collective individuality, and yet just like any other cosmic phenomena, no different than any other form. The salient characteristic that distinguishes humans from all other forms, Kent would like to say, is our ability to reason, which is why he regards us as the highest form. And as such, given that we have the ability to reason, we're also given the possibility of free will. And with free will, the other end of the stick is that we can destroy our rationality. So optimally, our spiritual vital force, as ordained in its functionality as the vice regent of the soul, is charged with engaging and maintaining the free will in an effort to keep, and this is what Kent writes, to keep himself in continuous order so that his thoughts may continue rational. But we know that when disease occurs, whether genetic or acquired, when there is a separation of this influx or continuance of the simple substance, which is assigned through the spiritual vital force of an individual, then the interior and exterior disruptions that occur prevent one from fulfilling the assigned mandate. So as healers, then, it's our mission to identify all of the obstacles on all levels and to cure the individual from the lowest to the highest centers of the organism, and to provide the appropriate treatment, thus resulting in freedom for the patient, in order that this restoration is successful enough to adequately continue on its intended course, and thereby fulfilling the higher purposes of one's existence. So that's essentially what I covered last week, Kim.
Fantastic, David. Thank you for that summary, and thanks for getting us up to speed. Now that you've done that, can you be a little bit more specific about what are some of the main attributes of simple substance, and also could you explain a little bit about what actually are their importance?
Sure, and I'm delighted to, and perhaps it might be a bit more organized if I lay it out, several of the essential attributes of the components in a sort of heading format. And then I'll elaborate on them a little later on.
Okay, that sounds perfect.
So the first is that simple substance is subject to changes, and this simply means that it can flow in either order or disorder. And this is why Kent says that an individual has the possibility of destroying his rationality and move into a place of dis-ease, as much as he or she has the possibility of evolving with it and utilizing it as a vehicle to help fulfill one's purpose. So in this regard, then, the attribute of change moving into order or disorder indicates really a wonderful thing, Kim, and that is that simple substance is completely objective and impartial toward everything. Another attribute, a second attribute of simple substance, is that it may pervade the entire material substance without disturbing it or replacing it. And in this regard, Kent uses the illustration of the magnetization of a needle. So we all know that every aspect of the original needle is never changed in any manner, shape, or form when it's magnetized. And it remains constant if the needle is equally demagnetized. And the same applies to ourselves as human beings. However, the same observation is only possible in its ultimates, that is, when the life force has been compromised or severed from the human organism and death is the consequence. And here we see that the physical body remains the same as only moments before, but the absence of vital force clearly demonstrates the animation bestowed upon it constitutes and defines the whole of its existence of what we call human being or a person. So, for example, if you break a rock in half and now you have two rocks, the alteration from one piece into two smaller pieces does not in any way marginalize or diminish its existence or, let's say, its rockness. But take the life of another person, for example, or another person dies and permanently removes the vital force, and you have nullified that very entity that we call a person. And therefore, of course, there are grave consequences to pay inwardly and outwardly should we kill somebody, but still the life force does animate the entire organism. Then he goes on to say that the third attribute of simple substance is cohesion. And this is a very obvious characteristic property and one which we take for granted. And this attribute allows for the adherence of all particles to actually become the thing that we have come to know them to be. That is, the stuff, as it were, that allows all entities to assume their physical form, which in turn has the possibility of fulfilling their purpose. For example, when any form returns to its ultimates, that is, whenever it's broken down, cohesion of the particles, cells, molecules, atoms, subatomic material, etc., no longer exists, and they remain detached from one another. But in their constructive state, that is, when they're created, it's really not as though all these constituent tiny subatomic pieces are running around with crazy glue trying desperately to attach themselves to one another. So it's simple substance that permeates the whole of an entity, in fact the creation of an entity, that admirably unites the entirety of a thing to become just the very thing that it is and that we identify it to be. So this then leads us to the fourth attribute of simple substance, which is an active substance, when simple substance takes on a more active role. And again, I'll quote Kent. And he says, when a simple substance is an active substance, it dominates and controls the body it occupies. It is the cause of force. The body does not move, think, or act unless it has its interior degrees of immaterial substance, which acts upon the economy continually in the most beautiful manner. But as soon as the body is separated from its characterizing simple substance, there is a cessation of influx. The energy derived from the simple substance keeps all things in order. By it are kept all order of functions and the perpetuation of the forms and proportions of every animal, plant, and mineral. All operation is due to the simple substance, and by it, the very universe itself is kept in order. It not only operates every material substance, but it is the cause of cooperation of all things. Everything is in harmony and is kept so by the simple substance. We see cooperation in every degree, and this cooperation working in perfect harmony. So this is a very prosaic way of putting it, but we can see then that harmony is also one of the attributes of simple substance. But when this harmony is disturbed, the quality of the harmonic disturbance in the simple substance, which then causes a corresponding diminution in the free flow of influx and continuance, is then proportionate and reflective of the qualitative manifestation of impaired functioning of any organism. So maybe I should state that again, because it is concise, but as I'm known to be a little bit dense. So again, when this harmony in simple substance is disturbed, the quality of harmonic disturbance in the simple substance, which then causes a corresponding diminution in the free flow of influx and continuance, is then proportionate and reflective of the qualitative manifestation of impaired functioning of the organism. So very simply, if you're feeling really lousy, your outward reflection and energy and external reality is going to reflect that inner state of feeling very poorly. So I hope these comments clarifies your question a bit.
Very interesting, David. Before we move on with more about the attributes of simple substance, could you just say a little bit more about the consequences of actually how this affects people and maybe even the whole planet?
Yes, and I think this is a good time to move in that direction, because this is very rich theoretical and philosophical material, but Kent, first and foremost, apart from being very objective, was a pragmatist. So, I'd like to address that. It's a great question, Kim. And it's large and somewhat provocative in its nature. So given the time constraints, I believe it's best addressed at this time in that theoretical and philosophical mode, but we'll bring it into pragmatic terms as well. So essentially speaking, when the totality of someone's parts are retained in admirable, harmonious, vital operation, as Hahnemann, Kent, and all genuine traditions of healers agree upon, then the reason and the healthy free will, which does the bidding of the vital force, are cooperatively engaged and work in this manner to help the individual perform the activities and are given the direction in his or her life which will ultimately fulfill the purpose of their higher existence. Then the nature and character of all those very activities are themselves equally corresponding and externalized as well, that is in life, as also admirable, harmonious, vital operation. That is, the external reality mirrors the cooperative nature of the inner state ordained by the vital force through simple substance. And again, the ancient dictum, Kim, as above, so below, applies here as well. So since recognizing the harmonious relationship of all things, which is given to us by this healthy vital force, and which originates from the higher, we are then impelled to honorably manifest that same quality of activity in our ordinary day-to-day existence, which in this regard is viewed as lower or more coarse, that is, less refined, but not negative by any stretch of the imagination. And in so doing, we actually fulfill the higher purposes of our existence by using this as a guide to determine the direction and purposefulness of our lives. But when there's a disruption in the force, as the great Master Yoda of Star Wars fame would phrase it, then no other result than ruination and death can ensue. Actually, I think Yoda was a closet Hanumanian at heart.
He certainly speaks in rubrics.
He certainly does. Anyway, when the vital forces met with this other spirit-like substance that we call disease, then both the external and internal reflective manifestations of this corruption to simple substance is clearly seen as an impaired functionality and diminished sensory capacities on all levels. So since this is lawful, the same can be said of the planet, and this is where both work under the same lawfulness, Kim. And this, the way that it works in the planet, which I believe we'll all agree upon, that this wonderful Earth is a living organism, as it appears that it follows its mandate to its particular vital force to perform its existence, also an admirable, harmonious, and vital operation as well. However, the consequences of the aggregate accumulation of human pathology over time has permitted us as a species not only to destroy our own rationality for a significant portion of the population, but it has transpired also over time that our collective irrational perception of reality, with all our modern advancements and attachments and inventions, really has permitted us to begin to encroach upon and interfere with the functionality of the planet to be able to fulfill its own harmonious obligations and purpose. So it's transpired in recent history, Kim, that a significant segment of the population, having been compromised through miasmatic and other various infringements, we've become desensitized to our own innate nature and mandate as it is. And by default, it seems that we've seen proper to extend the same level of irrationality toward our host planet. So as a consequence, the acquisition of material wealth has grossly overshadowed an innate and genuine desire for mental, emotional, and spiritual health, resulting in part to the current global crisis. And I'm not now speaking only of global warming. And although this might, from some point of view, be an unpopular topic among the highly educated and passionate and wonderful people who are listening now, but today's global warming, I'd like to say, may not be as simple and as obvious as many would have us believe. In fact, it may be only one of many symptoms of a larger planetary diseased state. This is certainly true for human diseases, so then why might it not be also true on a global scale? If you think about it, after all, the site of the cancer, according to our teaching, is only the outward representation of a deeper, more pernicious diseased state. So isn't it probable, then, that the lawfulness of simple substance in its non-discriminatory nature and universal application also has the same impact on the planet? Since the planet is also a living organism, why are we so quick to suggest that the planetary symptomatology is really different from human symptomatology, since both follow the same lawfulness of simple substance? So all I'm really suggesting is that as healers and residents of this miraculous planet, is for us to remain open and objective and to consider the possibility that there may be other factors to explore. And when you think about it, the very scientific community, which is ascribing greenhouse emissions as the major culprit with the smoking gun, no pun intended there, may not be looking in all the right places, and consequently, really not getting the whole story. So after all, it's the same scientific community with the same philosophical paradigm that's spending billions of dollars trying to find and identify dark matter, which Kent spoke of so eloquently about more than 100 years ago as being simple substance. And we discussed that in more depth last week. In fact, Tim, it's the same scientific community and the same scientific method when applied to medicine. Just recently, as of 2006, made what they call a major scientific breakthrough and discovery, and they now claim, and I'd like a drum roll, they now claim that there is conclusive scientific evidence to demonstrate that there is a mind-body relationship. Well, again, as my friend once put it, the scientists are slowly catching up to the yogis. So for me, you know, given the history of empirical science in the world, these and an enormous host of other findings really beg the question as to the ultimate credibility and authority that the scientific community has been bestowed upon it and covets. But really, don't get me started. In any case, back to this partial severing of influx and continuance of simple substance on the planetary scale. It's my feeling that our self-absorbed, irrational, and short-sighted interventions deprive the planet of the opportunity to fully discharge her mandated obligations by robbing her of some significant percentage of her well-intentioned manifestation, water, trees, air, oceans, and the like. So I think these manifestations are directly associated with her admirable harmonious vital operation, and regarding her sensations and her functioning, but through our pernicious intervention and interference are exhibited by the breaking and disrupting this absolutely beautiful, organic and natural, harmonious and cooperative relationship that have developed between all things and all kingdoms over millions of years. Basically, through human unconscious intervention, some of the links are being compromised. So in order to maintain her own homeostasis, the planet has been obliged, as we are obliged, to rearrange things in order to compensate for this severe disruption, which is still holding true to the dictates of her ordained mandate. I know this is provocative, and as I like to tell my classes on these types of subjects, we'll discuss them over lunch.
Well, I mean, I think it's very interesting, and I mean, I think a lot of people think like this, David, that if there is pathology within human civilization, that pathology is going to manifest on a global scale, and the consequences won't be simply on a micro level, but they'll actually manifest on a micro level and a macro level, and we will see the consequences on a much larger stage than just simply on an individual personal stage.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
And one thing that we have going for us, since the planet has to follow the same dictates of its vital force as we do ours, it will always sacrifice the lesser for the greater. So we'll be given smaller signs initially before the greater signs begin to manifest. The question is whether we can see them in time.
Right. Very interesting. So, David, are there any other essential attributes that belong to simple substance that we should know about?
Yes, there's just a few more, Kim, but they're equally as important as the ones I've just discussed. In his lecture, Kent writes, "The simple substance gives to everything its own type of life, gives it distinction, gives it identity, whereby it differs from all other things." So this is the intelligence that we've spoken of before, Kim. But it's important to note that each thing arises in its existence within the entirety of the whole of the universe, that is, due to that initiating causal factor. And then Kent goes further and states that while concrete matter is subject to reduction, that is, it's subject to its ultimates, breaking down, remember, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, etc. It can never be reconstituted. That is, it can never be returned to its original form. And with this said, he makes the argument that since each and every thing in the universe works harmoniously and cooperatively together, then each thing has a purpose. And therefore, we as humans as well have a purpose. and that there's an apparent intelligence to the entire scheme presupposes that the thing that created it all from that great beginning must be a supreme being, and Kent calls the supreme being God. But for our purposes, it really doesn't make any difference whether one believes from a religious point of view or spiritual point of view or not. The critical thing, and not to get hung up in religious ideas, is that there was a beginning, and from that beginning all things proceeded. So theologians and astrophysicists both agree on that point. So Kent writes of this in this way: "Now do you begin to see that the thing that does not start from its beginning with a purpose is not a thing? Or to put it another way, what makes anything a thing is because of its purpose or its ultimate, which is use. And is there never created a thing without a purpose?" So then everything has a purpose, is what Kent is saying, and it's a component in some larger plan that has already been harmoniously and cooperatively existing. And our mandate is to actively participate in that universal purposefulness. And another aspect of simple substance is that it may exist as simple, compound, or complex. And, Kim, what that means for us, Kent explains in the following passage: "When substances come together, they do not disturb the simple substance of each other. There is nothing destroyed. Each one retains its own identity, and they can be reduced again to their simples by reaction and reagents. Now, all of these enter into the human body, and every element in the human body preserves its identity throughout and wherever can be found, be identified. Such combination, however, merely represents a composite state. But when these composite substances and simple substances are brought into an additional condition, that is, when they're presided over and dominated by something, they may be said to enter into a very complex form. And in the body, the life force keeps every other force in order. Dynamic and simple substances often dominate each other in proportion to their purpose." It's a very, very profound statement. "One having a higher purpose than another. This vital force, which is simple substance, is again dominated by another simple substance still higher, which is the soul." So when Kent offers what I consider here to be a truly majestic cosmology of the universe, he presents his explanations of this phenomena of simple substance, and it seems quite in keeping that he offers also several other features as well, which include indications that simple substance belongs to another dimension of reality. Yet simultaneously parallel when compared to our own experience of concrete or material substance. So really what I mean by this is simply that while simple substance permeates everything existing, at the same time it is not bound to a number of influences that material substance is subjected to. And this is by way of clarifying the very clear distinctions between simple substance and concrete substance. So, for example, Kent states that simple substance is not under the influence of time, of place, space, gravity, weight, or quantity. And in regard to quantity, he says that it cannot be predicated of simple substance, only quality in degrees of fineness are applicable to it. And here he gives the illustration of its special relationship to homeopathy, and this is really important for us as homeopaths, when he offers that when we give a potency, when we move from one potency that's been repeated, but that its action has been exhausted, and then we move to another higher potency of the very same remedy, one gets a much better response on the part of the patient. And he writes, "Do we not see from this that what we have entered into a new series of degrees and are dealing entirely with quality?" So, Kim, it is this quality of experience that's not restricted to and transient of space and time and place and gravity and weight or quantity that allows us human beings to have the entire range of experiences that are available to us, both as we have lived up to this point and those that we might expect as a potentiality. That it's possible for us to simultaneously exist and adapt, because adaptation, remember, is part of simple substance, that we can adapt within this course of limitation of the physical body, and at the same time, we can have more experiences and adapt the quality, not quantity, but the quality of our lifestyle, our thinking apparatus, our reasoning, our free will, to correspond to the purposes of, as Kent would say, our soul, which he feels is the very higher purposefulness of our existence. And the soul, he postulates, inhabits and utterly permeates the entirety of the organism through the simple substance of vital force, which, as we've said before, is the vice-regent of the soul.
Very interesting. You know, David, Kant in various of his writings postulates the soul actually inhabits every aspect of the organism, and that's a very fascinating and pretty intricate concept. Can you share a little bit about the inner and outer relationship of that and what is the significance it has for us?
Yeah, sure. It's a very, very intricate relationship, as you say. And I feel that you're getting to what is the real relationship of the dynamic qualities of our entire organism. It is perhaps one of the more difficult concepts for us to understand, but it may be more comprehensible, for example, if I present it from the point of view as a harmonious, cooperative coexistence. And Kent wants to say that any organism without vital force is simply no longer the organism that it was constituted as, that it appears as. So he says vital force is simple substance. And as such, it contains the properties, as we have discussed, and this also includes energy or force as one of its constituent parts. And that's why Kent says energy is not energy per se, and in this case he's talking about simple substance preceding energy. But he writes about this topic in the following way. He says, "Now when we consider the substance as an energy, a force, or a dynamis, that is something possessing power, the subject is more intelligible." He says, "Inert elements have their nature, not only their own identifying simple substance, but they have degrees of this identifying simple substance." And I'd like to just give a clarification of what he might mean by degrees. If you have a rock in a river, and the rock is completely submerged and always has remained submerged in this river, what you'll find is that the rock does not wear exactly flat. And that is because there are different degrees of simple substance in that rock. Otherwise, all rocks would be absolutely flat all the time, which would be really good for stonemasons, but not so good for nature. But then he says the human body also has its degrees of life substance, existing in degrees suitable for all its uses. The innermost degrees of life substances are suitable to the will and understanding. So he wants to say, the very finest stuff of simple substance really belong to the innermost degrees of our existence, and they engage the will and our understanding. The outermost degrees of the very coarsest tissue, and there is one continuous series of quality in degrees from the innermost to the outermost. Every cell has within it the innermost and the outermost, because there is nothing in that which is coarsest, but has that which is finest too. The outermost envelopes are dominated by the coarser degrees of simple substance, and the innermost qualities are dominated by the innermost degrees. Each portion has an appropriate form, and from the outermost to the innermost, it has all. Otherwise, the human body could not be dominated or ruled by the soul. So that's really essentially it, Kim. Kent's notion of simple substance as it applies to our lives is that there exists within our entire being these varying degrees of functionality and sensations, all containing the qualities of the original message from the soul, as it were. But these only need to function within their given level of performance and operation in relationship to the whole functionality of our organism. Every part has its own individuality and purpose, and at the same time, it's informed of the whole structure and purpose, as it were. It's just an exquisite depiction and impeccable explanation of universal lawfulness and how it operates on all levels, from micro to macro phenomenology. And I just would also want to say that this is why the vital force is able, in its mandate, since it's not really a tool, as Hahnemann would say, that would be profitable to copy, but it can choose and does choose to sacrifice the lesser for the greater. And it's because of these varying degrees that we can have diminished functioning over a longer period of time rather than just turning the light on and off and either we're alive and fully functional or dead. So the gradation of degrees becomes very important to what the vital force is still capable of working with, even in a corrupted organism.
You know, that's a very lovely and very poetic elucidation of some very complex philosophical principles and ideas that are put forth by Kent. And I just to say I'm very impressed with that description. Very, very nicely done, David. I'm curious, David, you know, what does Kent suggest that all this means for homeopathy in general and really for us as healers in particular?
Well, I guess what he's ultimately going to say is, get a life and get a day job. But in reality, he's not saying that.
Yeah.
So it's a really interesting question because we're called. I mean, we have this conversation and this dialogue. There are these wonderful, genuinely caring people on the other end of the line. You have worked to create this institution of whole health now. There must be some motivating factor. There must be something that calls us to something that's more refined. And this is what Kent is really getting at. And he's saying, by his presentation of this fairly metaphysical and unique cosmology, he's suggesting that the acquisition of this knowledge could lead us into different directions than we've ever previously thought possible. It's important to bear in mind, Kim, that Kent, like Hahnemann before him, was acutely aware of both his message and his obligations to maintaining the outward integrity of homeopathy, which, as we know, is always set on a precarious fence within not only the medical community, but the society as a whole. And like Hahnemann, he was ever mindful of the cultural pulse that was or was not ready to receive his message. And today, 110 years later, clearly there's more leniency toward these ideas. And they're not as radical or seemingly preposterous as the time when Kent proposed them. So, for example, he categorically states that everything in the universe has an aura or an atmosphere. And this was decades before the discovery of Curlian photography, which, as I'm sure you and the other listeners on the line this evening know, is the scientific method of photographing the auras of all living things. And to suggest this reality in 1900 was indeed radical. But he does so nonetheless because of its importance to our ever-evolving study of the truths behind our art as healers. And with regard to this, he writes, and this is very radical stuff in his time, he writes, "The aura becomes useful and introduces a prominent sphere in the study of homeopathics." It's an amazing sentence and daring and courageous, but I really have to ask the question, where is this prominent sphere of study occurring in the schools of homeopathy today? Furthermore, what does it mean to study aura? What actually does it mean? Really, what does it entail? If this is a real knowledge of our art, it is unfortunately absent today, and I strongly feel that it needs to be resurrected and included in the curriculum. And I can categorically tell you, and everyone listening, what it is not. Understanding auras is not the ability to visually see shimmering 3D multicolored images around our patient's periphery to determine the extent of their illness, thus indicating a suitable remedy of like shimmering quality. This is exactly what Hahnemann and Kent would rail against, and which Hahnemann would refer to as supercilious speculations. So it's my deepest conviction, Kim, born out of experience, that the study of auras in the real sense of what Kent meant can be both acquired and taught to any serious student or practitioner. And this is what we do at our school. But it's absolutely based on objective reality of learning about the nuances and subtleties of simple substance rather than some airy-fairy notion concocted from the imagination. And I can share this because Kent writes, "The consciousness between two simple substances is really that atmosphere by which one knows the other, and by which all affinities and repulsions between simple substances are known." And so I'm fully convinced that this particular knowing that Kent refers to is not our intuition or intuitive sense that many ascribe, and which also plays an important function in our lives, but yet still another sense that we can develop and eventually utilize as a tool for our practice of healing. Because Kent, given his precarious position as a spokesman for homeopathy, was constrained from being too implicit regarding these ideas. However, he did leave a very definite thread to take hold of for any astute reader by writing this one simple sentence, which I'll repeat again. "This aura becomes useful and introduces a prominent sphere in the study of homeopathics." So, Kim, what Kent's proposing, in essence, is that we can develop a faculty within ourselves that is capable of having direct experience of one's own simple substance, which has the capacity then of interfacing with and recognizing the same with all other forms of all other kingdoms, including humanity. And that's essentially it. And next week, we'll look more carefully into these deeper relationships between simple substance and our role as healers in the medicinal art.
Very interesting. David, I want to open it up to let some other people ask questions, but before I do that, could you just quickly tell us a little bit about your school and how people can contact you if they want more information?
Well, yes, I can. Our school is the Hudson Valley School of Classical Homeopathy. We are located in New York, about 100 miles north of New York City, and we have two places that we teach. My wife, Ilona, teaches at the State University of New York at New Paltz, and the other is the master program that is given in our community house center healing milieu, as you were. It's where we do clinical cases, live cases in real time. We work with patients. We follow the six-week protocol for seeing patients, so there is a continuous six-week rotation for two years. Students are assigned cases and are charged with actively participating and working with the cases, and it's a wonderful, wonderful experience because it gives the students who are involved, once they finish, a very wonderful basic course in homeopathy with a real direction toward healing. They come in, take cases, and we really go over the deepest nuances of case taking, case management, follow-ups, and so on and so forth. You can find us at our website at www.classicalhomeopathy.com. That's classicalhomeopathy.com, and our email if you'd like to contact us. And by the way, thank you all out there for those of you who sent us wonderful responses from last week. They were delightful. The email address is classicalhomeopathy@earthlink.net.
Fantastic. And David, let me just add that my friend Dr. Gregory Pace is a naturopathic doctor who's been practicing homeopathy for more than 25 years, personally told me that his participation in your school was the single most critical factor in the development of his ability to practice homeopathy effectively. So that really says a lot, because I thought he was a great homeopath even before he participated with you in your school. So I think you're doing a great job. Let me go ahead and open it up for some questions. Does anybody have any questions they'd like to ask David Kramer? Can people hear me?
Yes.
Good. Anybody have any questions? You can ask him anything.
It worked, Kim. We scared them all away.
We're in awe.
Yeah, feel free to ask anything. You know, even if it's not specifically about simple substance, if, you know, David's been in practice for a long time. He's a very knowledgeable homeopath on many levels. So if you have any questions, go ahead and feel free to ask him. This is your opportunity.
I was wondering how your work, you know, Kent's stuff and what you're talking about fits with Bruce Lipton's Biology of Belief work.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not familiar with his work, so I can't comment on it.
Okay. He talks a lot about the cells having their own consciousness, et cetera.
Well, in that sense, it's very much what Kent is saying. So in that regard, if he's saying that there's an intelligence of on every conceivable level, then that's the direction that we're working with here. The same thing as in memory of water. You know, that's why every snowflake is different. Every blade of grass is different. Every leaf on the same tree is different. They have their own individuality.
Thank you.
Sure.
Great. Other questions,
David?
For David? Yeah, please.
Can you elaborate a little bit more? This is Maida from Clearwater on will and understanding.
Really?
I don't find too much on these two concepts.
Well, unfortunately, there's not a lot, but let me put it as succinctly as I can. Will is a motivating, moving factor of vital force. It is the thing that engages and then moves. A free will always move in accordance with the most pure directives of vital force, so that a free will always move toward its essence and its individuality, that is the real being of a person. Vital force that is unhealthy will not be able to manifest a free will that is genuinely free. And so that will then show up as becoming egotistical and willful and moving toward the lower realms of existence rather than toward the more refined realms of existence. Understanding, and it depends on your orientation, whether empirically Western, philosophical, or Eastern, but understanding is really the marriage of being and knowledge. Understanding is a euphemism for wisdom. Does that add any clarity to your question?
Yes, David, thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. That's generally a three-hour talk right there.
Hey, David, I have a question for you.
I have got a question.
Oh, go ahead, Krishna. Go ahead.
Do you mean that, you know, Ravi Shankaran write soul of the remedy, and the soul of the remedy, if it corresponds with the patient, rather, who is also suffering, and he may have the same symptomology as that remedy. And so that also comes into the same, like the theme as you are talking, like
I'm
the intelligence.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the whole question, but what I did get, does the soul of the remedy correspond to the suffering resonance of the individual?
Yes, that I mean.
Okay. Yes, absolutely. And if the individual is suffering at a more coarse level, then we'd need the lower potencies as a resonance. I mean, how many of us homeopaths have seen a case given a remedy and it was too high because it didn't resonate at the correct level? We give a lower potency, we have a beautiful result, and then once that beautiful result has run its course, we're now dealing with more finer substance, more simple substance. We have to give a higher potency. And it is, and I'm very happy that you raised this, it is the soul of the remedy that needs to correspond with the lack of vibratory quality in the individual. It has to augment. And so I thank you very much for raising that. It's a very significant and important point.
Fantastic. So on that wonderful end note, I see that we're just at the last minute of the call. David, I want to thank you again for doing an excellent job on a really fairly complex and difficult subject to understand in homeopathy. And I think you're doing a fabulous job of really weaving very disparate ideas into a cohesive whole so that we can really grasp and understand these important issues. So I want to personally thank you. And if everybody else can, we can give David a big thank you for taking the time out of his busy schedule to join us. I think that would be wonderful.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all, one and all. And thank you, Kim, again for the opportunity. And I hope
our pleasure, David.
And we're meeting next Thursday, is that correct?
Next Thursday is the third session.
Yep. The third session, and we'll be then discussing more of the intricacies of what's required of the practitioner to engage their own knowledge about acquiring an understanding of simple substance and how to apply it in their practice and in their lives, because that should be undifferentiated.
That's great. Thank you so much, David. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, everybody.
David,
thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Good night.